So I'm going to start with a poem like we often do. This one is by Kabir. Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. So even in our spiritual practice, that sneaky little craving, clinging is there. It's such a natural part of being human. So as Susan mentioned in her introduction, that we've changed our last Sunday of the month schedule so that you all have more time in the breakout groups to discuss the topic from the entire month. And so this morning my talk is mostly a recap of the talks that Lauren and Tiweri gave earlier in the month, and then I've offered some practice suggestions. So first, a few really good quotes on clinging, just because I find them so helpful. So from Gil Fronsdale, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. I think that's a great one. Joseph Goldstein, I am more attached to the energy of wanting than I am entranced by the actual object of my wanting. Kitasaro, when we see clearly the ever-changing nature of all conditioned phenomena, thoughts, feelings, perceptions of self and other, the futility of grasping for certainty becomes obvious. And another from Joseph. When we fully open to the truth of whatever has the nature to arise, has the nature to cease, we would be free of attachment and clinging to anything at all. And then from one of the poems that Tiweri read from the First Free Women, if you're going to tell yourself a story, why not a story of freedom? So clinging, as Susan said, is the ninth link in the cycle of dependent origination. But clinging is not just wanting or craving. It's like craving to the ninth power. It comes with a sense of that kind of absolute must have or must not have. So let me share some of the main points that Lauren and Tiweri shared over this month. Clinging leads to suffering. We are so lost in the absolute belief that we must have or must get rid of whatever is up, that suffering is the outcome. But just because something feels bad doesn't mean that we know that we're suffering. If we're irritated, for instance, we can be so absorbed in the thing or the object that we believe caused the irritation, instead of knowing that irritation is happening. Last week, Lauren gave that great example about wanting clean air when we were all in the midst of all that smoke. And she pointed out that the relationship we have to the object of clinging is what is important, not the object itself. We had a great discussion at the end about how wholesome it is to want clean air. But what Lauren was pointing to was the clinging about it, kind of her absolute demand that she felt about it, that there wasn't much acceptance during that time of this is the way things are and it feels terrible. She said that she spent more time wanting a happy ending than really feeling the suffering of the smoke and the bad air. I have my own example that comes from when you lose somebody you love. And of course, you're feeling so sad and confused and kind of discombobulated. And I was so grateful then and still now for my years of practice, because there were moments when I could see that even though Bill was dead, there were moments when I didn't say, this shouldn't be happening. This shouldn't have happened. I've shared this experience with you all before, but it seems so appropriate around clinging, is that a few months after Bill died, it was one of those gorgeous kind of fall winter mornings, and I was walking along the canal where I live, and the sky was blue and the water was clear and there were boats and people and the air felt good and it smelled good. And I remember the thought that came up that nothing was missing in this moment. So even when there's difficulty, even when there's, you know, you feel the suffering, there can be a lack of clinging where we can see what is actually happening. Lauren pointed out that the wisdom we've gained from our practice is so important as we're dealing with this particular link. You know, the examples that I just gave about clean air and also about death. She pointed us back to the three characteristics. Dukkha, the imperfect nature of life. Anicca, impermanence, that everything changes. And anatta, non-self, that most of what happens is not personal. It's just the arising and passing away of phenomena. We need the wisdom of the Dharma to really deal with craving and clinging. And we need that wisdom to become embodied in our lives. Tewari talked about the four kinds of clinging. First being to sense objects, those things that we believe will give us pleasure and that it's going to stay around. And of course, when it doesn't, we get really caught. The second is views and opinions, it's kind of where we first take this sense of ownership and identification. We forget that these are just subjective opinions, but we believe that they're facts. And the mind starts being filled with, I know, I believe, I have. The third kind of clinging is being absorbed. That was the language that Tewari used about these clingings, is being absorbed in them. Being absorbed by these rules or norms or traditions of a sense of these things are supposed to be this way. But of course, things don't work out the way we think they're supposed to be. And then the fourth is that fixed sense of self, where we say, well, I always respond this way, or I'm just an angry person, or you're this way and you always are that way. But just like everything else, the truth is that people, you and I, change all the time. Clinging, just like in Kabir's poem, shows us it's just a part of the nature of living in this realm. It's here. It's what arises. And when it does, it's not a personal deficit. It's not a problem. We're really encouraged to just know that this is what happens. Lauren told that great story about the Dalai Lama who was at a conference and was served cake, and he really wanted pie, and how he laughed at himself. You know, so that goes along with not judging, that the preferences and the desires are going to come up. And then not all desires lead to clinging, just in the Dalai Lama example, where we can see our preferences and then not get caught in them. Tewari said that, and she said this a number of times, that there are only three links in this cycle where we really have choice. The first is in Vedana, where we know things are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. The second is in craving, and the third is at the very end of the cycle. But once we're in the midst of clinging, this kind of demand that things be a certain way or that we have what we have, once we're caught in that, we're kind of lost. The hold is pretty tight on us. Tewari used the phrase of we get hijacked. And this hijacking happens in the craving link, which was last month's topic, because when we turn away from the discomfort, that's where we get hijacked. We hold on to the belief that things should be pleasant and pleasurable. And when they're not, we get all caught up in all kinds of afflictive emotions, disappointment, anger, irritability, ill will, blaming. When these emotions arise, we have a pretty good clue that clinging is present. So I have 7 practice ideas. The first is really what Tiwari said after she pointed us to that there's only 3 choice points. She says we need to fall back into the Vedana phase and craving, where we really can see that we have some choice. Remembering how important it is that when we notice that a sensation or a thought from the 6 sense doors, when we notice that they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, and that when Vedana is present, we can watch what the mind does, how it decides, oh, this is pleasant, I got to have more of this. Or this is unpleasant, I got to get rid of this, because if I don't get rid of this, then such and such is going to happen, and we get all caught up in a story. Or when things are neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and we try to stir up something that's more interesting, just because it's kind of unpleasant to be in the neutral place. So falling back into the Vedana, and when we first notice that craving, after we've noticed the preferences and the pleasant and unpleasant or neither. The second is turning towards the discomfort. We all know this. It is the first noble truth. We are invited to know what it feels like to suffer, to not turn away from the pain, the sensations, the unpleasant feelings. And we're encouraged to explore what's beneath the immediate feeling, because sometimes craving, or how it's defined as lust, can feel really pleasant. Or even anger, irritation can feel kind of pleasant because there's all that energy that's gotten stirred up. So when we turn towards the discomfort, we're also invited to look beneath what we first think is the discomfort. The third idea is to practice renunciation. It's the third of the paramis that Lyndall and I were just talking about last week at the Buddhist Essentials. Let go of your urge to build up a story. Really know when we're doing that. You know, renunciation is often defined as accepting the fact of impermanence, that things of this world go away. So we renounce, at least in the moment, the belief in permanency, the belief in, well, if I get this, then of course life is going to be great. Or if I push this away, if I get rid of this, life is going to be great. If I get this new job, if I find a new sweetie, if I move to a different place, if I get rid of my neighbor, fill in the blank. That kind of belief, if we can, even in the moment, renounce for just a moment, that we let go and we feel, well, what would it feel like if I actually let go of this belief? If I remember that everything changes. 4th is a reminder that our practice, each of our practices, no matter where you are in it, is a huge resource for dealing with craving, Vedana, and clinging. Remember what you know about the Dharma. The first noble truth that I just talked about, of really knowing suffering. Or the first foundation of mindfulness, where we're encouraged to really feel what's happening in the body, to stay in the body and trust what it is telling you. In one of Tiwari's talks, she talked about how you can trust the body way more than you can trust the mind. Or the third foundation of mindfulness, where you know you're caught up in the midst of all this craving and you ask yourself, well, what's going on? What's the state of my mind right now? Is it calm or is it all worked up and agitated? That could be an entry point for really knowing that you're caught up So along with how much our practice is a resource, is my fifth suggestion is to practice, 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 and a little bit more. Because when we're caught so much, it's where mindfulness is really needed. And remember that our meditation practice is about learning how to see and know what is going on in the mind, to know what is actually happening, to cut through some of our delusions about what's happening or our beliefs about what's happening, bringing that keen mindfulness in each moment where we can say, oh, I'm really caught up in this belief that if I just got a new job, life would be great. I mean, it doesn't mean you shouldn't look for a new job if that's what it is, but it's, again, goes back to that relationship with the object of clinging, you know, knowing what's real and what isn't. And around this practice is, you know, recommitting to the discipline of practice, remembering not only why you started, but remembering all of what has happened to you in the years or months or weeks that you've practiced, that you may have found moments of calm and insight and awareness that you didn't even know were possible for you. I think it's a way of really building confidence when you remember how much we benefit from this practice. It's both your individual on the cushion or in the chair practice, but also those moments when you're in life and you've really practiced wise speech, where you've really listened to somebody and noticed the assumptions and then didn't act on those assumptions. Or when you get all caught up and you know, oh my goodness, I am so caught up in wanting things to be different that I can't even function. So you just take a pause. I mean, all those things build up our confidence. And I think when we're dealing with this part of the cycle of dependent origination, we need the confidence of our practice. So in the sixth one is, if in your practice, like Susan was pointing out in the meditation, if you note what is happening, make sure you use impersonal language. So you might say, story making is happening, as opposed to, oh, I'm making up a story again, here I go. Or anger has arisen, instead of, oh, I'm angry again, or I'm irritated again, or I'm frustrated again. Oh, frustration has arisen. These conditions have happened and frustration has arisen. When we can depersonalize some of our language, it's really an easier way to deal with that fourth kind of clinging, that selfing. And my last suggestion has to do with self-care. You know, these are really challenging times for all of us. The pandemic, the smoke that we just had, and all the fires and the incredible devastation of nature, all the trees that are gone, the animals and the birds that have been affected, the people who've lost their lives or people who've lost all of their possessions, the struggles for racial justice, the political strife. I mean, and then you add all of your own difficulties, the sense of isolation. So remembering that self-care is what is going to help us do that discipline of practice, of going to come back to the cushion. It's going to help us then get in, really feel the ouch of suffering. There's a wonderful comic strip in the Seattle Times called Mutts. I just love it. It's about a cat and a dog. And the cat, for whatever reason, loves little pink socks. I don't know if any of you ever look at this. But a couple weeks ago, there are only two frames. And the first frame was the cat in the bedroom with dozens of little pink socks everywhere that he had been cuddling with and then throwing all around. And then the second frame says, kitty self-care. So whatever is your kitty self-care, and you know the difference between indulgence and self-care. I'm talking about things that really build up, like the build up the paramis, build up your resilience and your generosity, finding beauty in nature, art, or poetry. Because once we're nourished, we can come back to those moments where we're just caught up so much and we have a context, a container of compassion and kindness for ourselves and for others, that it's a little easier to navigate. This link of craving, when Tiwary was using that language of being hijacked and being so absorbed, and Lauren talked about, you know, just getting kind of lost in her desire for clean air and was kind of angry about it not being there. And in our discussion, we talked all about that. So we need to know what's going to feed us, what's going to nourish us enough to come back to really being with the discomfort, looking at the suffering, going back to the Vedana and the craving and seeing what's really happening. I just want to re-emphasize how much our practice is a resource for us. It's kind of self-evident because that's what we're doing here. But sometimes I think I sometimes forget that I know a lot about the practice. Each of us do. And if we kind of tap into it and just even ask ourselves, well, what's the Dharma telling me right now? Is this a moment to just remember the First Noble Truth? Or is this a moment to remember generosity and kindness or some of the other paramis or the four foundations of mindfulness or selfing, whatever it is? But asking yourself, what is my practice telling me that I need right now so that I can really be with the craving and the clinging that is present? So thank you very much for your attention. So for those of you who are staying, great, because I really find that we get so much out of the discussion that comes from Sangha. It's why it's such a jewel. Is that other people's experiences really help us understand. So I'm going to share the questions for you to look at. So here are some possible questions. The first is Gil's question, what is worth clinging to? The second is, what keeps you clinging? Do you have kind of a pattern that you notice? Are there certain circumstances that really get you caught up? And along with that, what helps you let go? And then if you prefer, you could just share more generally of how you've been understanding these 3 months of these links of Vedana, the feeling tone, craving and clinging, and how it's going for you. And during these very difficult times, you might even make it more personal in that way of how you're dealing with this, given that the circumstances that we find ourselves in are pretty difficult right now. So those are the questions. Alrighty, now everybody's back. So we've got some time for comments, questions. I was in a group of 3 parents, and we all shared about how in the process of parenting, clinging to certain views as to how things should be, wow, is that ever a big one? Mm-hmm. And we came out with really wanting to, you know, we appreciate the love that we have for our kids, no matter how old they are and how independent, and how long they've been living on their own. And we still want certain things for them. So every aspect of life, you know, gives us this opportunity to deal with practice.
I have one thought, Suze.
Yes, thanks, Arv. Please.
Yeah. No, I'm this talk was very moving for me, and I feel like I need to return to it and hear everything you said over and over. But one thought that occurs to me too, and this is very related to Ling had a comment in the chat. It seems like it's disappeared now when I look at it, but it was about sort of she mentioned loving suffering, and it pointed me to one thing, which is just that. You know, this progression that we've been through the last few months and next month with Becoming, you know, is getting more and more identified, more and more caught in these identities, these beliefs, these stories. And there's this terrifying notion that we've raised, which is that we can be trapped within it without knowing it, because we're so identified that we can't see it from the outside. And it occurs to me that the suffering, the intensity of suffering is almost, you know, the more intense it is, the more availability a path outside of it is, the more aching and painful it gets, the more we're actually able to see the path to the outside from which we can look at the thing that we're trapped within.
I think that's beautiful. Thank you. You know, it reminds me of Zen teachers. I think it's Dogen talks about the practice being a process of intimacy, of greater intimacy with, and it's, you're kind of speaking to the intimacy of the suffering, of the pain. And once we really turn into it, towards that discomfort, there is an opportunity that you're talking about. I think that's a beautiful way that, you know, it hurts so bad. I gotta, you know, it's really a gift in a kind of a backwards way.
Exactly.
This gift. Oh my God, the ouch is so big. I can't ignore it anymore. And then what do I know? That's where, you know, that gift of our practice and the Dharma and what we know and all those books that we bought and all the talks we've listened to and all the retreats we've gone on, and we have Rodney's voice or Tuwari's voice or Joseph's voice or whoever we listen to, you know, and we go there and we go, oh, they're telling me what I can do now. I'm feeling so, so much that ouch because I'm so identified. Yeah. Thank you I think that's really a beautiful way of describing it. Yes, Charlotte, please. Great.
Yeah. So what I've been dealing with is negative thoughts. It's more like regrets from the past that kind of hammer me in the head. And I really like what you said today about telling them what someone said. Telling a more, what did you say, a hopeful story do you remember what you said? A more hopeful story or more something. Anyway,
said something like that. Why don't we just tell a positive story or hopeful?
Yes, right. That's it. Yeah. And so I'm beginning to challenge those old memories and to maybe rewrite them or in my mind, because they do give me a lot of suffering. I mean, this is from 60 years ago. Regrets come up. Bang. Oh, who did that? Oh, I'm. Yeah. And what good does it do me to have all that stuff flooding back again? And so I could use some advice maybe about how to rewrite that. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up. I think that a lot of us can identify with that. So I have a 51-year-old son, and I have a view of what I was like as a mother when he was young, and that view is a pretty self-centered, me above others kind of view, which I think is somewhat true. I don't know how totally true. But every time I went on retreat, these regrets about not being a better mother to him would come up. And I remember one time at a Philip Moffitt retreat where we did both a forgiveness and a reconciliation process about, and the way he does reconciliations is between fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons, mothers and daughters, sisters and brothers, mothers and, you know, every possible relationship, and offering an opportunity to heal those relationships. And that really helped me a lot. The other thing that helped me, and I had the gift of the person that I felt a lot of regret for was still alive and in my life. And I actually talked to my son about it, and he looked at me and he said, "Oh, Mom, give it a break." Which I thought he was just saying to me, how important is this old memory, this old view? Mm-hmm. So those would be my two things about some reconciliation process around it to actually actively try to bring some healing to those experiences of regret, especially if they're in relationship. And then look at how much weight you're giving to it. It was how much weight I was giving to it. And of course, when I was doing this, he was already 30 years old. So I was regretting something that happened when he was 7, 8, you know? So, you know, kind of looking at the weight, the importance I was giving to it when the fact in and of itself had its importance was gone. It no longer was around. So that's just kind of my two bits worth. Does anybody else want to respond around regrets? Anything that has been useful, skillful in your life?
I might add, I had a huge, huge regret after my mother died because of the way that I had been. You know, I was very unskillful. And that's what got me to the practice. Big, big suffering. And what I did for one of the things that I did for a couple of weeks, I ended up in MBSR. That's how I got into this practice. But I listened to a forgiveness meditation by Bob Stahl. You know, you can find a lot of his stuff on Dharma Seed. But just forgiveness, I had to forgive myself, mm-hmm. and I had to find some forgiveness because it was eating me alive. It was eating me up, and so. That really, really helped. And then the practice. I mean, but I know that feeling, and it's a terrible, terrible feeling to have.
Thank you, Cheryl. Sure. So I want to make sure that we have time for our closing. And just to say that forgiveness practice really is part of self-care. It's like, what are we holding on to that is causing us ongoing regret, unhappiness, and forgiving ourselves is like we only know what we know when we know it. And if we had known better, we would have done better. I mean, that sounds kind of like pablum, but I feel like it's truth. So oh, Tina, do you have a quick one?
The forgiveness thing, the self-forgiveness, and you know, I know this is not Christian, but they say that in the Christian thing, let he who is without sin throw the first stone. Wow. So we're all sinners. And to imagine that somehow something you did is somehow far and away different than everybody else is probably not true.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
May I just add that I heard a lovely definition for sinning, and it's to miss the mark. It's not that you're going to hell, you know, whatever. You miss the mark. That's all. And we get on, you know, I just love that. It's so human, so forgiving.
Nice. Thank you. So thanks to everybody for this lovely time. And Susan will close us out. And I think it's so great that we kind of ended the discussion with going back to the heart, to love and forgiveness and reconciliation and connection. And It's a good reminder. So thanks, Susan.
You're